to ring, we all ignore it. I look toward Bernadette, but she only has eyes for Lynn Wells. If you want me to help find Mora, I say, trying to keep my tone calm, professional, matter-of-fact, all while my heart rate is spiking, you need to tell me what you know. Silence. Lynn Wells looks at Bernadette, who shakes her head. He can't help us, Bernadette says. Lynn Wells nods. This was a mistake. Both women rise. We shouldn't have come. They both start for the office door. Where are you going, I ask. Lynn Wells' voice is firm. We're leaving now. No, I say. Bernadette ignores me and circles toward the door. I shift my body to block her. Move, she says. I look at Lynn Wells. Mora is in over her head. You don't know anything. When Bernadette goes for the knob, I'm still in the way. Are you going to hold us here by force? Yes. I'm not bluffing. I've spent my entire adult life waiting for answers, and now that those answers are standing in front of me, I will not let them walk out the door. No way, no how. I will keep Lynn Wells here until I know what she knows. I don't care what that takes. I don't care about the ethics or legalities. Lynn Wells will not leave this room without telling me all she knows. I don't move. I try the crazy eyes, but they won't come. There's a quake inside of me, an internal shake, and I think they can see it. You can't trust him, Bernadette says. I ignore her and focus on Mrs. Wells. 15 years ago, I begin. I came home from a hockey game. I was 18 years old, a senior in high school. I had a great best friend and my twin brother. And I had a girlfriend I thought was my soulmate. I sat at my kitchen table and waited for my brother to come home. Lynn Wells studies my face. I see something I can't quite comprehend. Her eyes start to water. I know. Both our lives changed forever that night. Lynn, she waves Bernadette to silence. What happened, I ask. Why did Mora run away? Bernadette snaps. Why don't you tell us? That reply puzzles me. But Lynn puts a hand on Bernadette's shoulder. Wait outside. I'm not leaving you. I need to talk to Knapp alone. Bernadette protests, but she isn't going to win this one. I move away from the door just a bit. I'm still not taking chances. I open the door just enough so that Bernadette can slip through. I'm actually crazy enough to keep an eye on Mora's mom, as though she might try to bolt through it too. She doesn't. Bernadette eventually slides through the opening, throwing a baleful glare in my direction as she does. Mora's mom and I are alone now. Let's sit down, she says. You know how it was between Mora and me back then. Lynn Wells and I have turned the two chairs in front of Ellie's desk so that they are facing each other. I notice now that there is a wedding band on her left hand. She keeps turning and twisting it as she speaks. She waits for me to reply, so I say, I do. It was rough. That was my fault, at least most of it. I drank too much. I resented how being a single mother held me back from, I don't even know what. More drinking, I guess. And the timing didn't help, what with Mora being a teenager and all that goes along with that. Plus, she was naturally rebellious. Of course, you knew that. It was part of what drew you to her, don't you think? So you mix all that together and... She makes two fists and then spreads her fingers, indicating an explosion. We were struggling. I was working two jobs, one at a Kohl's, another waitressing at a Bennigan's. Mora worked part-time at Jensen Pet Store for a while. You remember that, right?
Yes.
Do you know why she quit?
She said something about allergies to the dogs.
There's a smile on her face, but there's no joy there. Mike Jensen kept putting his hand on her ass. Even now, after all these years, I feel that heat rush through me.
Are you serious?
But of course she is. Mora said you were hot-headed. She was afraid if she told you. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We lived in Irvington at the time, but when she worked at the pet store, we got a little taste of Westbridge. This woman I worked with at Kohl's gave me an idea. She said I should move into the cheapest housing in a town with good schools. Your daughter will get the best education that way, she said. That made sense to me. Whatever else you can say about Maura, she was whip smart. Anyway, that's what we did. You two met a short time later. Lynn Wells fades away. I'm stalling, she says.
So, skip ahead to that night, I tell her.
She nods.
Maura didn't come home.
I keep still. I didn't realize this right away. I was working a late shift, and then I went out with some friends, drinking, of course. I didn't get home until 4 in the morning. Maybe 4. I don't even know. I don't remember. I don't think I checked her bedroom. Great mom, right? I also don't know if that would have made a difference. If I saw Maura wasn't there, what would I have done differently? Probably nothing. I would have figured that she stayed at your place or went to the city. She visited friends in Manhattan a lot, though not as much once you two started dating. And when I finally woke up and Maura wasn't there, well, it was close to noon. I figured she'd gone out already. That made the most sense, right? So I didn't think much of it. Then I went to work. I had a double shift at Bennigan's. It was near closing time when the bartender said there was a call for me. That was odd. I got scolded by the manager for that. Anyway, it was Maura. In my pocket, I feel my phone vibrate. I ignore it. What did she say? I was worried, you know, because like I said, she'd never called me at work, so I hurried over and said, "You okay, hon?" And she just said, "Mom, I'm going away for a little while. If anyone asks, I'm too upset by what happened and I'm changing schools." Then she tells me, "Don't talk to the police." She takes a deep breath. You know what I say back?
What?
The sad smile is back. I ask her if she's high. That's the first thing I ask my daughter, who is calling me for help. I say, "Are you high or something?"
What did she say?
Nothing. She hung up. I'm not even sure she heard me. And I didn't even know what Maura meant by being upset by what happened. See, I was that out of it, Nap. I didn't even know about your brother and that Stiles girl yet. So I just went back to work, you know, waitressing. I got 2 tables complaining by now. And I was taking an order at a table across from the bar. You know, they got all those TVs on.
I nod.
Well, usually it's on sports, but someone flipped it over to the news station. That's what I saw.
She shakes her head. God, how awful. They didn't say any names, so I didn't even know it was your brother or anything. Just 2 Westbridge students got run over by a train.
So maybe now Maura's call made a little bit of sense to me. I figured she was upset by this, wanted a few days away to deal with it. I didn't know what to do, but I've learned a few things in my life. One was not to react too quickly. I'm not the smartest woman. Sometimes if you have a choice of taking Road A or Road B, you should just stay where you are until you know the lay of the land. So I calmly finished my shift. Like I said, it all made sense, except, well, what about the part about not talking to cops? That part bothered me. That I was too busy working to think about it much. So, anyway, when my shift was over, I went out to my car. I was supposed to meet up with a guy I'd started seeing, but I didn't want to anymore. I just wanted to get home and hunker down. So I walked out to the lot. It was pretty empty by then. And there were these men there waiting for me. She turns away and blinks.
Men, I repeat.
4 of them.
You mean like cops?
That's what they said. They flashed badges at me.
What do they want?
They wanted to know where Maura was.
I'm picturing this. Bennigan's had closed down years ago, replaced by another chain restaurant called the Macaroni Grill, but I know the parking lot.
What did you tell them?
I said I didn't know.
Okay. They were very polite. The lead guy, the one who did all the talking, he had this pale skin and whispery voice. Gave me the chills. His fingernails were too long. I don't like that on a man. He said that Mora wasn't in trouble. He said that if she just came forward now, it would all be okay. He was very persistent.
But you didn't know.
Right.
So then what?
So then?
I see her eyes filled with tears. She reaches her hand up and puts it on her own throat.
I don't even know how to tell this part.
I reach out now and put my hand on hers. It's okay. Something has changed in the room. You can feel it like an electric surge. What happened next, Mrs. Wells?
What happened next?
She stops, shrugs.
It's a week later.
I pause. Then I say, I don't understand.
Neither do I.
Next thing I remember, I hear pounding on my back door. I open my eyes, and I'm in my own bed. I peek through the shade to see who was there. She looks at me.
It was you, Nat.
I remember this, of course. I remember going to their house and pounding on that back door, searching for Mora, who had not contacted me since my brother's death other than to say that the news about my brother was too awful, that she was going away, that we were over.
I didn't answer the door, she says.
I know.
I'm sorry about that.
I wave it off. You said something about it being a week later.
That's just it, see?
I thought it was the next morning, but a full week had passed. I didn't know what to do. I tried to recreate what had happened. The most likely thing was that I drank myself into an extended blackout, right? I figured the pale man with the whispery voice thanked me for my time, told me to get in touch if I heard from Mora, and left me. And I got in my car and went on a bender. She tilted her head. Doesn't that sound like the most likely explanation, Nap?
The room feels 10 degrees cooler.
But I don't think that's what happened.
What do you think happened, I ask.
I think the pale man with the whispery voice did something to me. I can hear my breathing like seashells pressed against my ears.
Like what?
I think they took me someplace and asked me about Mora again. I had these memories when I first woke up, bad memories. But they disappeared like after a dream. You ever have that? You wake up and you remember the nightmare and you think you'll never forget it, and then the images just slip away.
I hear myself say yes.
That's what it was like. I know it was bad. Like the worst dream possible. I reach out and try to remember, but it's like grabbing smoke.
I nod more just to have something to do, some way to handle the blows.
So what did you do?
I just...
Lynn Wells shrugs. I went to work at Kohl's. I thought I'd get in huge trouble for missing shifts, but they said I called in sick.
And you don't remember doing that?
No. The same thing when I went to Bennigan's. They said I called in sick, too.
I lean back now, try to take it in.
I got paranoid, too. I kept thinking I was being followed. I would see a man reading a newspaper, and I'd be sure he was watching me.
You started coming around the house, too, Nap. I remember snapping at you to go away, but I couldn't keep that up. I knew I had to do something until Mora told me what was going on, so I did what she said. I told you that lie about her transferring schools. I contacted Westbridge High, too. I told them we were moving and would let them know where to forward Mora's records. The school didn't really ask too many questions. I think a lot of your classmates were devastated and taking time off.
Lynn Wells puts her hand to her throat again. I need some water.
I get up and circle behind the desk. Ellie keeps a small fridge under the windowsill. I wonder why Mrs. Wells came to me via Ellie, but there are more pressing matters. I open the fridge, see the anally laid out water bottles, and grab one for her.
Thank you, she says.
She twists open the top and takes a deep pull like, well, an alcoholic.
You quit drinking, I say.
You're always an alcoholic, she says, but yes, it's been 13 years since my last drink.
I nod my approval. Not that she needs it.
I owe Bernadette for that. She's my rock. Just when I was at my lowest, I found her. We got legally married 2 years ago.
I don't know what to say to that. I want to get back on topic, so I just say, okay.
And then I add, when did you next hear from Maura?
She takes another swig and twists the top back on the bottle. Days passed, then weeks. I jumped every time the phone rang. I thought about telling someone, but who?
Maura had said not to go to the police, and after what I experienced with that pale guy, well, like I said, if you aren't sure about Road A or B, just stay where you are.
But I was scared. I had terrible dreams. I could hear that whispery voice asking me over and over about where Maura was. I didn't know what to do.
The whole town was grieving over your brother and Diana. Diana's father, the police chief, he came by one day. He wanted to know about Maura, too.
What did you tell him?
The same thing I told everyone else. Maura was freaked out by what happened. I said she was staying with my cousin in Milwaukee for a while and then transferring schools.
Was there a cousin in Milwaukee?
She nods. He said he would cover for me.
So when did you hear from Maura again?
She stares at the water bottle, one hand on the white top, the other cupping the bottom.
3 months later.
I stand there, trying not to look stunned. So, for 3 months, I had no idea where she was. I had no contact, nothing.
I don't know what to say. My phone vibrates again.
I worried a million times over. Maura was a smart girl, resourceful, but... You know what I figured?
I shake my head.
I figured she was dead. I figured the pale man with the whispery voice found her and killed her. I was trying to stay calm, but really, what could I do? If I went to the police, what would I say? Who would believe me about that missing week, or any of it, really? Whoever those guys were, they either killed her, or if I made too much noise, I was going to help them kill her. Do you see my choices? Going to the police wasn't going to help her. Maura either was making it on her own, or
she was dead, I say.
Lynn Wells nods.
So where did you finally see her?
At a Starbucks in Ramsey. I went to the bathroom in the back and suddenly she came in behind me.
Wait. She didn't call you first?
No.
She just showed up?
Yes.
I try to comprehend this.
So what happened?
She said she was in danger, but that she'd be okay.
What else?
Nothing.
That was all she said?
Yes.
And you didn't ask?
Of course I asked.
For the first time, Lynn Wells has raised her voice.
I grabbed her arm and desperately hung on. I begged her to tell me more. I apologized for everything I did wrong.
She hugged me and then she pushed me away. She got out the door and headed out the back. I followed her, but...
You don't get it.
So explain it to me. When I came out of the bathroom, there were men there again. I gave it a second to make sure I'm hearing right. The same men? Not literally the same, but one headed out the back door, too. I got to my car, and then...
Then what?
When Lynn Wells looks up, when I see the tears come to her eyes and her hand go to her throat again, I feel my heart plummet down a mineshaft. Some might say that the pressure of seeing my daughter again sent me on another bender.
I reach out again and take her hand.
How many days this time?
3.
But you see it now, don't you?
I nod.
Maura knew.
Yes.
She knew that they would interrogate you, maybe with drugs, maybe harshly. And if you didn't know anything...
I couldn't help them.
More than that, I say.
What do you mean?
Maura was keeping you safe, I tell her. Whatever made her run... If you knew about it, you'd be in danger, too.
Oh, my God.
I try to focus. So what then, I ask?
I don't know.
Are you saying you haven't seen Maura since that day in Starbucks?
No. I've seen her 6 times.
In the past 15 years?
Lynn Wells nods.
Always by surprise. Always a quick visit to let me know she's okay. For a while, she set up an email account for us. We never sent anything. We would both just leave it in our draft files. We both had the password. She used a VPN to keep it anonymous, but then she started to think that was too risky. And in a way, oddly, she had nothing to say to me. I told her about my life, about my quitting drinking and Bernadette. But she never said anything about her own life. It was torture for me. She holds the water bottle a little too tightly. I have no idea where she's been or what she's been doing. My mobile phone vibrates again. This time I glance at it. It's Augie. I put the phone to my ear. Hello?
We found Hank.
Chapter 17. Do you remember Hank's 10th birthday party, Leo? It was a big year for laser tag and Nerf wars and sports-themed parties. Eric Cubey had that soccer party in an indoor bubble. Alex Cohen had her birthday at that mall with mini-golf and a rainforest cafe. Michael Stodders had video games and virtual reality rides. They strapped us in and shook the seats and we stared at the screen. It really felt like we were on a roller coaster. You got sick on that one. Hank's party, like Hank, was different. His was held in a science laboratory at Reston University. Some guy with thick glasses and a white lab coat led us through a series of experiments. We made slime using borax powder and Elmer's glue. We made high-bouncing polymer balls and giant ice marbles. We did lab stuff involving chemical reactions and fire and static electricity. The party was better than I thought it would be. A geek heaven, even the jocks would love. But the part I remember best is the expression on Hank's face sitting right up front, his eyes wide and dreamy, that dorky smile plastered to his face. Even then, even as a 10-year-old, I got how happy Hank was, how much in his element, ha-ha, how rare it was for any of us to reach this particular high. Even then, and I doubt I could have articulated this, part of me wanted to stop time for him. Just let him stay in this moment, this room, his friends and his passions locked together for longer than the 45 minutes of entertainment followed by 15 minutes of cake. I think back now about that party, about the purity of that moment for Hank, about the directions our lives take, and what the timeline was between that moment and now, the link between that happy boy with the dorky smile and the naked and mutilated dead man hanged by his neck from a tree. I can still look on the face, bloated, grotesque, decaying even, and see that little boy at the party. It's weird how you can do that with people you grew up with. The stench knocks everyone else back a step, but for some reason it doesn't bother me. I've seen my share of dead bodies. Hank's naked corpse looks like someone ripped out his bones, a marionette held up by one string. Cut marks, probably made by a sharp blade, cover his torso. But the thing that keeps drawing your attention is the most obvious one. Hank was castrated. I'm surrounded by my two superiors. On one side of me is Essex County Prosecutor Lauren Muse. On the other side is Augie. We are all staring up in silence. Muse turns to me. I thought you asked for a few personal days. Not anymore. I want this case. You knew the victim, right? Years ago. Still. No way. Muse is one of those tiny women who seem to emanate great strength. She gestures to a man heading down the hill. Manning will take it. Augie still hasn't spoken. He, too, has seen his share of dead bodies, but his face is ashen. County has jurisdiction in homicides. The town of Westbridge, Augie's department, offers only support. My job will be to liaise between the two. Muse looks back over the hill. Did you see all those media trucks?
Yes.
You know why so many showed up?
I do.
That viral video. Muse nods. A man is outed as a sexual predator via online vigilantism. The video has, what, 3 or 4 million hits? Now that man is found in the woods, hung from a tree. When it gets out that he was castrated. She doesn't have to finish. We all get it. A total shit show. I'm almost glad now I'm not the lead on this one.
Alan Manning walks past us like we aren't there. He stands by Hank's slightly swaying remains and makes a show of inspecting him. I know Manning. He's not a bad detective. But he's not a good one either. Muse takes a step back. Augie and I follow her.
Augie tells me you spoke to the mom who posted the video, she says to me.
Suzanne Hansen.
What did she say?
That she lied? That Hank didn't really expose himself.
Muse slowly turns toward me. Come again?
Mrs. Hansen just didn't like an undesirable hanging around the school.
And now he's dead,
Muse says with a shake of her head. I don't reply.
Ignorant, stupid.
She shakes her head again.
I'm going to see if we could charge her with something.
I have no issue with that.
Do you think maybe Mrs. Hansen is involved in this? Muse asks.
No, I think to myself. And I want to be honest, I don't want to lead Manning off the scent, but I also want what's best for the case, which may involve slight misdirection. So I say, I think the Hansens might be a good place for Manning to start. We stare up at the body again. Manning is circling underneath it, his face scrunched up. His manner is too showy, like something he saw on TV, and I half expect him to whip out a giant magnifying glass a la Sherlock Holmes. Augie still has his eyes on the corpse.
I know Hank's father.
Then maybe you should be the one to notify him, Muse says, and with the press already buzzing around, the sooner the better.
Do you mind if I go with him, I ask?
She shrugs a suit yourself.
Augie and I start walking away. Franco Cadedu, the county medical examiner and a good guy, has just arrived. He passes us with a stern nod. Franco is always all business on the scene. I return the stern nod. Augie does not. We keep walking. The crime scene guys, dressed in full bodysuits and surgical masks and gloves, hurry past us. Augie doesn't so much as glance at them. His face is set, trudging toward a dreaded task.
Doesn't make sense, I say.
It takes a moment or two for Augie to reply. How's that?
Hank's face.
What about it? It isn't purple, or even a different hue than the rest of his body. Augie says nothing. So he didn't die from strangulation or a broken neck, I say.
Franco will figure that out.
Another thing. The smell, it's beyond rancid. You can see the start of decay. Augie keeps walking. Hank disappeared 3 weeks ago, I say. My guess is he's been dead that long.
Again, let's wait for Franco.
Who found the body?
David Elephant, Augie says. He's walking his dog off-leash. The dog ran this way and started howling.
How often does Elephant do that?
Do what?
Walk his dog here. This ravine is somewhat out of the way, but it isn't that remote.
I don't know why.
Let's say I'm right. Let's say Hank has been dead for 3 weeks.
Okay.
If Hank's body had been hung up on that tree all that time, don't you think someone would have spotted it by now? Or noticed that smell? We aren't that far away from civilization, right? Augie doesn't reply.
Augie, I hear you.
Something isn't right.
He finally stops and turns back toward the crime scene in the distance.
A man was castrated and hung from a tree, he says. Of course something isn't right.
I don't think this is about that viral video, I say. Augie doesn't reply. I think it's about the conspiracy club and that old military base. I think it's about Rex and Leo and Diana. I see him flinch when I say his daughter's name.
Augie.
He turns and starts walking again.
Later, he says.
What?
We'll talk about it later,
Augie says.
Right now I just need to tell Tom that his boy is dead.
Tom Stroud stares down at his hands. His lower lip trembles. He has not spoken not one word since he opened the door. He knew. Right away. He looked at our faces and knew. They often do. Some claim that the first step in the grieving process is denial. Having delivered my share of life-shattering news, I have found the opposite to be true. The first step is complete and immediate comprehension. You hear the news and immediately you realize how absolutely devastating it is, how there will be no reprieve, how death is final, how your world is shattered and that you will never, ever be the same. You realize all that in seconds, no more. The realization floods into your veins and overwhelms you. Your heart breaks, your knees buckle. Every part of you wants to give way and collapse and surrender. You want to curl up into a ball, you want to plummet down that mine shaft, and never stop. That's when the denial kicks in. Denial saves you. Denial throws up a protective fence. Denial grabs hold of you before you leap off that ledge. Your hand rests on a hot stove. Denial pulls your hand back. The memories of that night rush in as we enter Tom Stroud's home, and part of me longs for that protective fence. I had thought that it was a good idea to come, but seeing Augie deliver bad news, the worst news, just as he did that night you died, is hitting me harder than I had anticipated. I blink, and somehow, Tom Stroud becomes Dad. Like Dad, he stares down at the table. He, too, winces as though absorbing punches. Augie's voice, a blend of tough, tender, compassionate, detached, brings me back more than any sight or smell, the nightmarish déjà vu, as he tells yet another father about the death of his child. The two older men sit in the kitchen. I stand behind Augie, maybe 10 feet back, ready to come off the bench, but hoping the coach doesn't call my number. My legs feel wobbly. I am trying to put it together, but it is making less and less sense. The official investigation, the one undertaken by Manning and the county office, will, I'm certain, concentrate on the viral video. It will seem simple to them. The viral video goes public, the public is outraged, someone takes matters into their own hands. It is neat. It makes sense. It may even be correct. The other theory, of course, is the one I will follow. Someone is killing off the old conspiracy club members. Of the 6 possible members, 4 have been killed before their 35th birthday. What are the odds that there is no connection? First Leo and Diana, then Rex, now Hank. I don't know where Beth is, and of course, there's Maura, who saw something that night that caused her to run away forever. Except, why now? Let's say somehow they all saw something they shouldn't have that night. Again, this may sound like paranoid thinking, even if the group was called the Conspiracy Club, but I need to play it out. Suppose they all saw something that night. Maybe they ran. And the bad guys only, what, caught Leo and Diana? Okay, stay with that. So then, again what? They dragged Leo and Diana to the railroad tracks on the other side of town and made it look like they were killed by a train. Okay, fine. Let's assume the others ran. Maura they couldn't find. That all works. But what about Rex and Hank and Beth? Those 3 never hid. They stayed in high school and graduated with us. Why didn't the bad guys from the base kill them? Why would they wait 15 years? And talk about coincidental timing. Why would the bad guys finally kill Hank around the same time that viral video came out? Did that make sense? No. So how is the viral video tied into this? I'm missing something. Tom Stroud finally starts to cry. His chin goes down to his chest, his shoulders start to spasm. Augie reaches across and puts a hand on Tom's upper arm. It's not enough. Augie moves closer. Tom leans forward and starts sobbing onto Augie's shoulder. I see Augie in profile now. He closes his eyes, and I see the pain on his face. Tom's sobs grow louder. Time passes. No one moves. The sobs start to subside eventually. They fade away. Tom Stroud pulls back and looks at Augie.
Thank you for telling me yourself, Tom Stroud says.
Augie manages a nod. Tom Stroud wipes his face with his sleeve and forces up a smile of some sort.
We have something in common now.
Augie looks a question at him.
Well,
something horrible. Tom continues.
We've both lost children. I know your pain now. It's like being members of the worst club imaginable.
Now it is Augie who winces as though absorbing blows.
Do you think that awful video had something to do with it? Tom asks.
I wait for Augie to answer, but he seems lost now. I take the question for him. They'll certainly be looking into that, I say.
Hank didn't deserve that. Even if he did expose himself,
he didn't. Tom Stroud looks at me. It was a lie. My mother didn't like Hank hanging around the school. Tom Stroud's eyes grow big. I think about those grieving steps again. Denial may be quickly giving way to anger.
She made it up?
Yes. Nothing in his expression changes, but you can feel his temperature rising.
What's her name?
We can't tell you that.
Do you think she did it?
Do I think she killed Hank?
Yes,
I answer honestly. No.
Then who?
I explain how the investigation has just started and offer the expected doing-all-we-can platitudes. I ask him if he has someone he can call to be with him. He does, a brother. Augie barely says a word, hanging by the door, rocking back and forth on his heels. I settle Tom in as best I can, but I'm not a babysitter. Augie and I have been here long enough.
Thanks again, Tom Stroud says to us at the door.
Just in case I haven't uttered enough banalities, I say, sorry for your loss. Augie heads out first, starting up the walk. I have to hurry to catch up with him.
What's up?
Nothing.
You got awfully quiet in there. I thought maybe you got an update on your phone or something.
Nope. Augie reaches the car and opens the door. We both get in.
So what gives? I ask.
Augie glares through the front windshield at Tom Stroud's house.
Did you hear what he said to me?
You mean Tom Stroud? He keeps glaring at that door.
He and I have something in common now.
I see a tremor hit his face.
He knows my pain.
His voice is thick with disdain. I can hear his breathing thicken and grow labored. I don't know what to do here, how to play it, so I just wait.
I lost a beautiful, vibrant, 17-year-old daughter, a girl with all the promise in the world. She was my everything, Nap. You get that? She was my life.
He looks at me now, the same glare. I meet his eye and don't move.
I woke Diana up for school in the morning. I made her chocolate chip pancakes every Wednesday. When she was a little girl, I took her every Saturday morning to the Armstrong Diner, just the two of us. And then we'd go to Silverman's and buy ponytail holders or neon scrunchies or those tortoiseshell clips for her hair. She collected hair stuff. I was just the clueless dad, what do I know? All of that stuff was still there when I cleaned out her room. Threw them all away. When she had rheumatic fever in seventh grade, I slept in a chair at St. Barnabas for 8 straight nights. I sat in that hospital and watched her and begged God to never hurt her. I went to every field hockey game, every holiday concert, every dance recital, every graduation, every parents' day. When she went on her first date, I secretly followed them to the movies because I was so nervous. I stayed up every night she went out because I couldn't fall asleep until I knew she was home safe. I helped her work on college essays no one ended up having to read because she died before she could apply. I loved that girl with all my might every single day of her life, and he... Augie practically spits the word out toward Tom Stroud's house. He thinks now we have something in common? He thinks what? That he, a man who abandoned his son when things got tough, knows my pain?
He hits his own chest when he says the word my. Then he stops, grows quiet. His eyes close. A small part of me wants to say something comforting, something along the line that Tom Stroud just lost his son, and so we need to cut him a little slack, but most of me gets exactly what Augie means and doesn't feel the need to be that generous. When Augie opens his eyes, he stares at the house again.
Maybe we need to look at this in a new way, he says.
How's that?
Where was Tom Stroud all those years?
I stay quiet.
He claims he was out west, Augie continues, opening a fish and tackle business.
With a gun range in the back, I add. Now we both stare at the house.
He also claims he came back every once in a while, tried to bond with his kid who rejected him.
So? Augie doesn't answer for a moment. Then he lets loose a long breath and says,
"So maybe he came back 15 years ago.
Seems a stretch, I say.
It does, Augie agrees. But it might be a good idea to check on his whereabouts.
Chapter 18. When I arrive back home, the Walshes are outside. I give them the big Mr. Friendly smile. Look how harmless the single guy is. They wave back. They all know your tragic story, of course. It's legend in these parts, as they say. I'm surprised none of Westbridge's wannabe Springsteens has written The Ode to Leo and Diana. Still, they all think that it can't happen to them. That's how people are. They all hunger for the details, not solely because they are ghoulish, that's part of it, no question, but more because they need to know that it can't possibly happen to them. Those teens drank too much. They took drugs. They took foolish chances. Their parents didn't raise them right. They didn't watch closely enough, whatever. Can't happen to us. Denial isn't just for the grieving. I still haven't heard back from Beth Lashley. That troubles me. I call the Ann Arbor Police Department and locate a detective named Carl Legg. I explain to him that I'm looking for a cardiologist named Beth Fletcher, née Lashley, and I'm getting the runaround from her office staff. Is she wanted in connection to a crime? Legg asks me. No, I just need to talk to her. I'll head over to her office myself. Thanks, no worries. I'll call you when I know more. The house is quiet. The ghosts all sleeping. I head up to the second floor and pull the handle. The ladder to the attic comes down. I climb up and try to remember the last time I was up here. I guess I helped bring your stuff to the attic, but if I did, that memory is gone. Maybe Dad spared me and did it himself. Your death was sudden. Dad's was not. He and I had time. He accepted his fate, even as I denied it. By the time his body gave out, Dad had already unburdened himself, and thus me, of most of his worldly possessions. He gave away his own clothes, packed up his room. He tidied up before the Reaper arrived, so I wouldn't have to. The attic, no surprise, is musty and hot. It's hard to breathe. I expect there to be a ton of boxes and old trunks, all the stuff you see in movies, but there's very little. Dad put down a few planks of wood, that's it, so that most of the floor is pink insulation. That's what I remember most. You and I would come up here as kids, and we'd play a game of having to stay on the boards, because if we stepped on the pink, we would fall straight through the ceiling and land on the floor below. I don't know if that's true, but that's what Dad always told us. I remember as a kid being scared of that, like the insulation was quicksand, and I would step on it and sink in and be gone forever. You never run into quicksand in real life, do you? For something so huge in movies and TV, you never actually hear about anyone getting trapped or dying in quicksand. This is how my mind is roaming as I spot the box in the corner. That's it. One box, Leo. You know Dad wasn't big on material goods. Your clothes are gone, your toys are gone. Purging was part of his grieving process. Not sure what stage that would be. Acceptance, maybe? Though acceptance is supposed to be the last step, and Dad had a bunch more to go through after the purge. We know Dad was an emotional man, but his full-body sobs, the way his chest heaved and his shoulders trembled, his wails of thunderous agony, frightened me. There were times I thought he would physically break in half, that his ceaseless anguish would cleave his torso or something. And no, we never heard from Mom. Did Dad reach out and tell her? I don't know. I never asked. He never told me. I open the box to see what Dad saved. Here is a thought I haven't had until right this second. Dad obviously knew that you would never be able to open this box. He also knew that he himself would never open it either. That means whatever is in here, whatever he chose to save, would hold value only to me. Whatever Dad saved, he saved thinking that I might one day want it. The box is sealed with tape. It's hard to peel off. I take a key out of my pocket and use it to slice down the seam. Then I pull back the cardboard and peer inside. I don't know what I expect to see. I know you. I know your life. We shared a room for your entire life. It isn't like anything huge is unaccounted for. But as I see the photograph on the top, I feel newly lost. It's a snapshot of the four of us, you and Diana, Maura and me. I remember it, of course. The photo was taken in Diana's backyard, her 17th and last birthday. It was a warm October night. We'd spent the day down at Six Flags Great Adventure. Augie had a friend, a retired cop who now worked for a major park sponsor. And he was able to get us wristbands that gave us limitless access to the Fastpass lane. No lines for the coasters, Leo. Do you remember? I don't have a lot of memories of you or Diana on that day. We broke off, you and Diana staying mostly in the arcade area. I remember you won her a stuffed Pikachu, and Maura and I went on the hardcore coasters. Maura wore a crop top that made my mouth dry. You and Diana took a goofy picture with one of the Looney Tunes characters. Which one? I bet it's... Yes, the second photo. I pull it into view. You and Diana standing on either side of Tweety Bird, the Six Flags fountain spouting water behind you. 2 weeks later, you'd both be dead. I study the photograph of the four of us some more. In the picture, night has fallen. Other partygoers are mingling behind us. We are all tired, I guess, a long day. Maura sits on my lap, our bodies entwined in a way only dating teenagers can achieve. You sit next to Diana. She isn't smiling. You look stoned. Your eyes are glassy and hazy. You also look troubled, maybe. I didn't notice then. I was into my own stuff, wasn't I? Maura and hockey and making a first-tier college. Fate, I was certain, would secure my future happiness. Though I had no real plan, no clue what I wanted to be, I only knew that I would be a huge success. The doorbell rings. I put the photo back and start to stand, but the ceiling is too low. With my back bent, I head toward the opening. As I climb down the ladder, the doorbell sounds again. Then again. Impatient. Coming! I shout. I trot down the stairs and see out the window that it's my old classmate, David Rainiv. His high-end business suit seems tailored by a higher entity. I open the door. His face is ashen and crumpled, even as his Hermes tie stays perfectly Windsored. I heard about Hank. I don't bother to ask him how. The old saw about bad news traveling fast has never been truer than in the age of the Internet. Is it true? I can't really talk about it. They say he was found hung from a tree. The sadness is etched all over his face. I remember him wanting to help when I asked about Hank at the basketball courts. There's no point in being a hard-ass here. I'm sorry for your loss. Did Hank hang himself? David asked. Or was he murdered? I'm about to tell him again that I can't talk about it, but there is an odd desperation on his face. I wonder now whether he came to me for confirmation or something more. Murdered, I say. His eyes close. Do you know something about this, I ask? His eyes stay closed. David? I'm not sure, he says at last. But I think I might. Chapter 19. The Rainivs live at the far end of a Tony New cul-de-sac in one of those McMansions with an indoor pool, a formal ballroom, 800 bathrooms, and 1 million square feet of mostly useless space. Everything about the house screams nouveau riche. The driveway gate is an overly ornate metal sculpture of children flying a kite. It is all wanting to look too old by looking too new. It's labored, trying too hard. Tacky. But that's my take. I've known David a long time. He's always been a good guy. He's generous to charities. He gives his time and energy to the town. I've seen him with his kids. He's not one of those poser fathers. You know the ones who make a big production out of watching their kids at the mall or park. So you think, wow, what a caring father. But you can see it's just an act for public consumption. That's not David. Most of all, I see his devastated face now. And I remember how he went through the timeline of his friendship with Hank. That kind of loyalty is the mark of a man. So I don't like his or maybe his wife's taste in houses. Who the hell cares? Get over ourselves. Stop judging. We pull into a garage the approximate dimensions of a college gymnasium. Is that judging? And park. He leads me through a side door and down into what some homes call a basement, but this one has a theater room and wine cellar, so we need to find a new term. Lower level, maybe? He heads into a small room and flicks on a switch. In the back right corner, there is a 4-foot-high old-fashioned safe with a big dial. You're not the cop on the case, right? This is the third time David has asked me that. No. Why, is that a big deal? He bends down and starts fiddling with the dial. Hank asked me to hold something for him. Recently? No. 8, 9 years ago? He said if he was ever murdered, I should find a way to give it to someone I trust. He warned me not to give it to anyone in law enforcement or anyone involved in the investigation. David looks back at me. You see my dilemma. I nod. I'm in law enforcement. Right. But like I said, this was 8, 9 years ago. Hank was already pretty out of it by then. I figured it was nothing, just the ramblings of a diseased mind, but he was pretty adamant about it. So I made a promise to him that if he was ever murdered, I would do the right thing by him. I never really thought of what that meant because, I mean, it was just incoherent rambling, right? Except now. He makes one last turn of the dial. I hear a click. He reaches for the handle, and as he does, he turns back and looks up at me. I trust you, Nap. You're in law enforcement, but I somehow think Hank would be okay with my giving this to you. He opens up the safe, reaches into the back, digs through whatever else is there. I don't pry by looking, and pulls out a video cassette tape that smacks me in the face with deja vu and sends me, pardon the pun, reeling. I remember Dad buying you a Canon PV-1 digital video camcorder sophomore year. You freaked out with joy. For a while, you filmed everything. You wanted to be a director, Leo. You talked about making a documentary. The pain hits me anew at the thought. The cassette David hands me is in a red plastic case that reads Maxell 60 Minutes, the exact same kind you used. Of course, you weren't the only one who used Maxell tapes back in the day. They were pretty common, but seeing one again after all these years. Did you watch it? I ask. He told me not to. Any idea what's on it? None. Hank asked me to keep it safe for him. I just stare at the cassette another moment. This probably has nothing to do with it, David says. I mean, I heard about that viral video of him exposing himself. That was a lie. A lie? Why the hell would someone do that? He's Hank's friend. I owe him something. I give him the quick rundown on Suzanne Hansen's moronic motives. David nods, closes the safe, spins the dial. I assume you don't have anything that plays this kind of tape, I say. I don't think so, no. Then let's find some place that does. On the phone, Ellie says, Bob found an old Canon in the basement. He thinks it still works, but it may need a charge. I'm not surprised. Ellie and Bob throw out nothing. Even more disturbing, they keep everything organized, so even something like an old video camera that hasn't seen the light of day in a decade will be neatly labeled and kept complete with its charging cord. I can be over in 10 minutes. You'll stay for dinner? Depends on what's on the tape, I say. Right, yeah, that makes sense. Ellie hears something in my voice and knows me too well. Everything else okay? We'll talk. I hang up first. David Rainov is driving, both hands on the wheel at 10 and 2. I don't want to make a big thing of it, he says, but if there is no next of kin, could you send the body to Feeney's funeral home when you're done and tell them to send me the bill? His father is back in town, I remind him. Oh, right, David says with a frown. Forgot about that.
You don't think he'll step up?
He shrugs. The guy let Hank down his whole life. I don't know why we'd assume he'll come through now.
Good point. I'll check and see.
I'd take care of it anonymously, if that's okay. Get the guys from basketball there, pay their respects. Hank deserves that. I don't know what people deserve or don't deserve, but I'm okay with whatever. It would mean something to him, David continues. Hank was big on honoring the dead. His mom... His voice grows soft now. Your brother, Diana.
I don't say anything.
We drive a bit more. I have the tape in my hand, and I think hard about what he just said and ask, what did you mean?
About?
About Hank honoring the dead, about my brother and Diana.
You serious?
I look at him. Hank was crushed by what happened to Leo and Diana.
That's not the same thing as honoring.
You really don't know?
I assume the question is rhetorical.
Hank took the same walk pretty much every day. You know that, right?
Right, I say. He started the path by the middle school.
And do you know where he ended up?
It suddenly feels like a cold finger is traveling down the back of my neck.
The railroad tracks, David says. Hank ended his walk on the exact spot where, well, you know.
There's a buzzing in my ears. My words seem to be coming from very far away now. So every day, Hank started his walk by the old military base. I'm trying not to sputter. And ended it where Leo and Diana died?
I thought you knew.
I shake my head.
Some days he would time the walk, David continues, a couple of times. Well, this was strange.
What?
He'd asked me to drive him, so he could time how long a car ride would take.
A car ride between the military base and the tracks on the other side of town?
Yes.
Why?
He never said. He was jotting down calculations and muttering to himself.
Calculating what?
I don't know.
But he was focused on how long it would take to get from one place to another?
Focused?
David is quiet for a moment. Then he says, I'd say he was more like obsessed. I only saw him at the tracks, I don't know, 3 or 4 times.
It would be when I took the train into the city and we'd drive by him. He was always crying. He cared, Nap. He wanted to honor the dead.
I try to absorb all this.
I ask David for more details, but there's nothing.
I ask him about anything else he might know connecting Hank to Leo, connecting Hank to the conspiracy club, connecting Hank to Rex, Mora, and Beth, connecting Hank to anything else about the past. But again, I come up empty.
David Rainiff pulls up to the front of Ellie and Bob's house. I thank him. We shake hands. He reminds me again that if anything is needed to give Hank a proper funeral, he's ready to step up. I nod. I see he wants to ask something more, but he shakes it off.
I don't have to know what's on the tape, he says. I get out and watch him drive off.
Ellie and Bob's lawn is manicured as though they are preparing for a PGA Tour event. Their flower boxes are coordinated and symmetrical to the point that the right half of the house looks like a precise mirror image of the left. Bob opens the door and greets me with the big smile and the firm handshake. Bob works in commercial real estate, though I don't quite get exactly what he does with it. He's a terrific guy, and I would take a bullet for him. We tried going out a few times on our own to Yag's Sports Bar to watch some NCAA March Madness or the NHL playoffs, bro time. But the truth is, our relationship fizzles without Ellie. We are both okay with this. I've heard that men and women can't be friends without there being some kind of sexual component, but at the risk of sounding horribly PC, that's horseshit. Ellie comes over more warily than usual and kisses me on the cheek. I think we both know after the whole meeting with Lynn Wells that there is unfinished business between us. But right now I have bigger concerns.
I have the video camera out in the workshop, Bob says. It doesn't have a charge yet, but as long as you keep it plugged in, it works.
Thanks.
Uncle Knapp!
There are two girls, Leah, age 9, and Kelsey, age 7, come ripping around the corner as only two young girls can. They both wrap their arms around me as only two young girls can. nearly tackling me with their loving onslaught. I would do a lot more than take a bullet for Leah and Kelsey. I would shoot plenty in return. As godfather to both, and a man with virtually no other family, I dote on Leah and Kelsey and spoil them right up to the line where Ellie and Bob have to admonish me. I quickly ask them now